Good morning, everyone. Welcome to day three of the 49th annual ARS conference. Before we get started this morning, Mike Beal has a couple of very short videos that he would like to present to us. Mike?
Leah and I don't only have our video cameras here when we're doing the ARSC conferences. We take our video cameras all over the country and all over the world. And we've had a chance in the past month to visit two very, very special people. And they want to send you their conference greetings to the bunch at ARSC. And it's very appropriate that that I use that title because they are both Edison experts. The second one that you'll see is the Edison expert, Ray Weil. But we will start with one of the British members who has graced our conference, had graced our conference for many years, and as a matter of fact, there's a picture. A bunch of pictures that I put up on Facebook, on the ARSC Facebook page, of a group of us at the antique mall outside of this city at the first conference we had at Chapel Hill, and both these gentlemen are in there. And Joe Pengelly is the visiting fireman. You'll see him in a fireman's hat on that photograph, but not here because we were the visitors in Joe's house in Plymouth, England. So if we could hear Joe. And it starts off first with some silence before we get the video. And he's standing by his turntable. And that's Thorne Park across the way.
Well, I'm old Joe Pengelly, very, very old. But I have very fond memories of ARSC. People like Kurt Nuck. I remember him giving me the tie off his shirt. And who else can I think of? Ray Weil. And all the staff at the Edison site were good to me too. But ARSC was my, that was the authority I was seeking, and that's what I got. And they were all so very well, so helpful. Tim Brooks, other names that come behind. And then there was another big chap. What was he called? I think he was called, what was he called? What's his name? What's his name?
You talking about me?
Yeah, I'm talking about you. Anyway, everybody knows him. I don't even need to mention him by name. Mike, it's great to have you here, and for you, Leah. It's the second association I have with the name Leah, because I remember working at the Edison site, and Leah Burt was very much in evidence. But I'm very old now. I lose the power of speech all the time, but take me as I am. But very, very fond memories of ARSC.
Joe is now 89 years old. And just after we went to the unveiling of the George W. Johnson grave marker in Queens, we went to see our good friend Ray Weil, who is now 91 years old.
Wait a second. Hey, now we go.
Hi, everyone. Wish I could be with you, but age and infirmities have sort of limited me, and I wish I could be writing and finishing everything that I used to do. But I remember the time when ARSC was formed and was one of the original ones who started the society. All sorts of publicity at the time at Syracuse University. And those were the days 40 or 50 years ago. May have recently seen that I did the smart thing and allowed the Edison people to come in and select records that they needed rather than giving the entire batch to them, so it would be they would have to do the sorting. But this took them 4 years to do it, of coming over here maybe once every couple of months. So the Edison people got a good group. I also remember driving up with Mike Beale to Toronto to one of the first ARSC meetings held at the University of Toronto. I think that's about it.
Okay.
So there it's one of our founding members, Ray Weil. So I hope you enjoyed the greetings to the bunch at ARSC.
Well, it's a particular honor for me this morning to be able to introduce our next guest. John Tefteller and I, it seems, shared some similarities in our childhood. We were both collecting and dealing in records from a very young age, from before either one of us were even able to drive. But at the age of 16, his life took a turn that my life has never experienced anything like it, I would imagine. When he became the archivist and sound engineer for Groucho Marx. That lasted a couple of years until Groucho's passing, and then he went on to work for the Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Radio, Drama, Variety, and Comedy, and I hope I got that right. And then also for Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters. Today, John runs his own company, World's Rarest Records, where he deals in 78 RPM, 45, and LP recordings of blues, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, and is very well known for that. He's particularly well known for a purchase that he made last year, and I'm sure that he will elaborate on that during his talk. Please join me in welcoming John Tefteller.
Thank you, Kurt, and good morning. Is everybody awake? Okay, we want this to be lively. I don't have any music to play, but I have stuff to say, and we have a microphone we can pass out for questions, so you can ask. All right, first I want a show of hands. How many in this room consider themselves record collectors? Okay, that's about 80% of the room, maybe 90% of the room. How many of you have 1,000 or more records in your collection? Almost the same number raised their hands. Okay. In talking to people over the last 40 years, one of the things I've discovered is that the average American family from the 50s and 60s had about 200 records in their collection. They were roughly the same 200 records, depending on what genre we're talking about, but it's always roughly the same 200 records. It seems like when you get past that level and get up to 500, you're considered a little bit more of a collector rather than just someone who likes music. And when you get up over 1,000, you're probably in the real eccentric collector mode. Well, some of us have things like 400,000 records, so I don't know how crazy that makes me, but you can figure that out. Some year or two back, my wife and I, we travel all over the country looking at record collections for my business and for personal, and we were in Missouri outside of St. Louis, went to see a guy because he supposedly had a lead on a Charlie Patton record. He didn't have it, but he had a lead on where one could be. And so we went to this little hovel of a house outside St. Louis. The house looked like it was probably not repaired in at least 20 years. Inside, it didn't look like it had been dusted or cleaned in at least 20 years. And here on the wall was these rows of records. Somehow, the conversation got around to the fact that there was no wife present in the house. It was simply another bachelor record collector. And so the question was put to this gentleman as to what became of your wife? Because there were a picture, it was a picture there, but no wife. And he said, well, she came to me one morning and said, I'm leaving you. And he said, I looked at her and I said, I don't know why in the world you would leave me. You're never going to find another man with a record collection like mine. So that's the kind of thing you deal with. I consider myself a record entrepreneur. No government funding. Never received a dime from the state or the federal government or Congress or anybody. I just work very hard. My wife says I'm a workaholic, doing something with the business all the time. I'm traveling constantly. I produce reissue CDs with the help of Richard Nevins of early blues material, which I share inside a blues calendar that comes out every year with old original graphics and photos of blues singers. Oh, some people like it. Okay, good. As Kurt said, I've been collecting and messing with records since about 1974. I'm a dealer in records to pay for what I like to keep, as well as support my family. When I was in high school, I used to go around to yard sales on the weekends and pick up used rock and roll LPs that weren't too used, but still in pretty nice shape. And I would bring them to school on Monday morning. I had a trunk full of albums, and I'd buy them for 50 cents and sell them for $2. And that's how that got going. In college, I started an international mail order business in addition to studying in college. Didn't get much studying done, but that was okay, because after I graduated, I did the mail order business full time for records. I guess some people refer to me as the record detective, because I travel all over everywhere. I'll go into any small town, any big town, any bad neighborhood, any good neighborhood, doesn't matter. I'm out there looking for those records all the time. In fact, yesterday afternoon, at Rich Nevin's suggestion, we went wandering around antique stores in this local area. So sorry if I missed any of your presentations. Didn't find anything, but couldn't resist the beautiful day and the idea to get out and go look for some records in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I've been tracking record values and trends in what sells and what doesn't for the past 40 years, sort of like some people track the stock market or the art market or the gold market or whatever collectible market you want. So I kind of have a really good feel as to what is collectible and what isn't. First of all, if you're looking at records as an investment, you must be very careful. Not everything goes up in value. Many records have gone down in value, especially with eBay and all of the stuff that goes up there, where you'll see as many as 100 and 200 copies of the same record for sale in a week. So I can only speak authoritatively on the types of records I deal with. I can tell you about blues, rhythm and blues, jazz, a little bit about country, and a lot about rock and roll from the 50s and 60s. I don't have anything to do with classical, opera, easy listening, ethnic, any of that. I don't have any knowledge in that, and I haven't tracked that over the years, so I can't speak to what's happened with those markets. In general, common records will always be common. So if you want to talk about making money in records, don't buy common records. You can buy them if you like them and enjoy them, and that's fine, but don't expect to ever be able to sell them for much money. And as time moves along, those common records will still be common. Maybe 200 years from now, somebody will be hunting for that special Bing Crosby record, but even that, I don't think they're going to have much difficulty finding, even 200 years from now. There'll be plenty of white Christmases for generations to come. Rare records, on the other hand, genuinely rare records, always seem to find buyers, whether it's on eBay or private auctions or just person to person. Rare records always seem to find buyers. Now, that's rare records in certain categories. There are records that are rare simply because they didn't make very many of them, but the buyers are even rarer than the records are. no one seems to care. So you have to be careful with that. Don't think that just because something is rare that there will be a buyer. It has to fit in with some different categories in order to make that happen. One of the things I've collected is early material on early record collecting. So I've looked for old newspaper articles, magazine articles, anything about when record collecting first started. And the earliest one I found was from 1935. There may be an earlier one that some of you know about. But the earliest one I found was 1935, and in that publication, the collectors were talking about collecting mainly vintage opera and classical discs from the early part of the century. There was a mention that jazz might be an up-and-coming collectible, which was interesting, but it was mostly about classical and opera. Around 1940, there's a number of publications that start talking about jazz as a collectible, and they mention things like King Oliver's on Jeanette and all that in 1940. Most of the 1940s, the record collectors were still the opera and classical, but with also a heavy focus on jazz, early jazz, the late 20s, early 30s period in jazz. In the 1950s, it's still mostly jazz, but as you move towards the middle to the end of the 50s, blues starts kicking in a little bit. Some people discovered the blues records by that point. In the 1960s, it seems that jazz on 78 is still a big deal. Blues is becoming a little bit more of a big deal. And also, a lot of the East Coast area is starting to pop up with a lot of R&B vocal group collectors, guys that like that early doo-wop harmony sound from the 1950s. By the time we get to the 1970s, jazz is still pretty hot with the old-time, what they were calling themselves by that point, the Moldy Fig crowd. Blues had become more popular. The main focus that I saw in the 70s, even as very young, was the fever for R&B vocal group records by the New York and East Coast area 45 collectors. Also, the 50s rock and roll stuff started to really catch on in the 70s. In the 1980s, it was still R&B vocal groups, blues, 50s rock and roll. When you get into the 1990s, it went to 60s music began to catch fire. Soul, what they now call Northern Soul, which is kind of hot now, but to me a very volatile thing to be investing in or buying. But 60s music, rock and roll, soul. R&B vocal groups were at their peak in the 90s, and that has pretty much held true today. Jazz LPs were still good, 50s jazz LPs, the Blue Note sound, all that modern bop type stuff. In the early 2000s, blues was really going wild in sales, and that's the eBay stuff started and all of that. R&B vocal groups fell off a bit, but were still popular. Now we're in 2014, and blues seems to be the number one collectible as far as value goes. Also good now is still the rock and roll of the 60s. The 50s has fallen off a little bit, but the really rare stuff still sells. Northern Soul is big. 60s music is big. Jazz LPs are still big on the internet. Rockabilly is a big thing now. It was a little bit before, but it's pretty hot now. R&B vocal groups are not quite so vibrant. That's an older generational thing, it seems. They haven't translated well to a younger generation. Just to give an example of some prices, if we're talking about records as an investment, I was talking to Don Kent, who showed up here for a little while the other day, and he said in 1963 he was able to buy a Robert Johnson Vocalion for $7. Now, that's 1963. He said in 1972 he bought another one and it was $75. So a bit of an increase in there. In 1985 you could buy one in really nice shape for about $1,000. 1995 it was starting to get to where people were dividing up those records by title, and some titles were more valuable than others. It wasn't just any Robert Johnson you could buy for $1,000. By the mid-90s, they were dividing them up by title, and they were between $4,000 and $8,000 for nice copies in 1995. In 2005, they went from 4,000 to 8,000, up to 5,000 to about 12,000 for a really nice Robert Johnson 78. And I think they're on track now for next year to be somewhere between 8,000 and 20,000, depending on title. So those are what I call icon records. There are others along the line of that in blues and other categories, but that gives you an idea of the kind of price rises that are possible with certain records. There was a price explosion in the blues starting in the 90s. Somebody said yesterday it was when Rush Shore sold his collection to pay for his divorce, and he priced all the records at way above what he thought they were worth and then wound up selling almost all of them. So that was pretty much the beginning of that in the 1990s. For the future, my recommendations for records, if you want records as an investment, stick with what are truly rare records. Don't buy things that you see for sale all the time and expect that they'll be valuable in the future. They might be, but if you go for the truly, truly rare things by the icons of the genre, you should be pretty darn safe by doing that. An icon would be what my friend back there, Richard Nevins, refers to as a masterpiece record, something that is recognized as a masterpiece of the genre by both people who love the music and also those who write books and magazine articles and newspaper articles saying these are the important people from that time period. That would be in blues like Robert Johnson, Charlie Patton, Son House, Skip James, Mississippi John Hurt. The next category of records that are good as investments would be obscure records, not those big name people that I just mentioned, obscure records that are good, musically good. Buying obscure records just because they're obscure is not going to help your wallet very much. They have to be musically good. They will follow the Robert Johnsons and the Charlie Pattons just a little bit slower and further behind. Mainstream popular records will either stabilize or fall in price over the next 10 or 20 years as all of us get older and more of those common type records come on the marketplace. There's already loads of them on eBay that don't sell, that are more common records. Records, in a way, can be like real estate. First of all, they're not making any more of them. That's an obvious thing. But with real estate, sometimes the very best pieces of real estate don't tend to go down much in value. The very best records don't tend to go down much in value. Pre-war anything will always be scarce just because of the scrap drives during World War II and all that kind of thing. And really good pre-war records will be next to impossible to find in the wild, so to speak, at an antique mall, at a thrift store, an estate sale, over the next 10 to 20 years. They're pretty hard now. They've been getting increasingly harder, and it won't be too much longer before you won't see any of that stuff out there. Whatever exists, whatever still has survived, will be in the hands of private collectors or institutions. Condition is always a critical aspect of buying records for any type of investment purposes. If you want to buy records that are beat up or scratched or scuffed because you want to listen to them, fine. Don't buy them as an investment that way unless they're really super rare, one-of-a-kind type things. And then if they're that rare, the condition doesn't really matter. It does, but not as much as with everything else. I would say buy the records that you like if you don't care what will happen to your records when you're gone, and just keep them and enjoy them. And when you're gone, they're the problem of your children or the next generation. If you buy the icon records and the very, very rare things, you then take on a responsibility of what to do with those, because those records are very special. Whatever they are, the icon records in whatever categories, those are very special. And if you have those, you need to be thinking about how to pass those along to the next generation. Carrie Janelle put me on the spot last night, which was good, saying, what are you going to do with yours? And I didn't have an answer, and I still don't have an answer. But to think about it is a good idea, and I think everybody should think about that. As far as predictions for things that would be happening over the next 10 or 20 years, the really rare stuff will be really rarer and more expensive. There's no let up in anything like that that I can see. I can see in 10 years, $25,000 Robert Johnson 78s. Now, I don't know how many buyers will be around at that level, but with really good icon type records, there's usually one or two. And it only takes two, especially if I'm involved, to get it up there in price. One other thing I mentioned in the little description of what I was going to talk about, don't hoard your records. Make them available to people for reissue projects. It doesn't do anybody any good, except you, to have a very rare performance in really nice condition sitting in your closet or on your shelf and not having that available on a reissue of some sort that sounds good. And there are some people out there that just simply hoard records and don't make them available when it's time to do the reissues. And I want to make sure that I stress that nobody in this room should do that. I learned that from Richard Nevins, who's sitting back there. He's been very inspirational to me, and I want to thank him publicly for all of the work he's done in remastering records. I think they're the finest reissues ever made. People ask me what is the most fun for me in record collecting. The most fun for me in record collecting is finding something that has been long considered lost. And I've been pretty good at that with all the running around the country over the last 20 years. Finding the missing Paramount records, for one, and some other things. And that is the best joy I have in record collecting, is finding one of those things and then giving it to Richard for remastering, and then seeing it come out and letting everybody else enjoy it. So many things have been lost and destroyed over the years that when you find something like that, it makes all the hours on the road and all the motel fees and restaurant fees and all that, makes it all worthwhile to find something like that and say, okay, now we can give it back and let everybody hear it again. And that's what I've been doing with the reissues that I do. But I want to make sure to stress that I want reissues to sound good. And many, many reissues out there do not sound good. They're very sloppily done, and they don't have the care that they should. Personally, I hate MP3s. I don't like the sound that comes from them. I hate iPods. My son has one, but the sound that comes from them is not interesting to me at all. And I hate poorly remastered, dull sound on CDs that were not taken good care of. Records have life. They have life inside them, and digital has put a great many records on life support because they weren't properly transferred and remastered. I think everybody who's raising their hands saying they have 1,000 or more records kind of need to make sure they have life in perspective a little bit. I've seen the hoarders across the country. In fact, a couple weeks ago, I was in Pennsylvania in a house that was about 100 years old. The gentleman who owned the house had died. He had a space that went from the front door about 10 feet in. That was clear. There was a little desk and a garbage can. He literally died bent over the garbage can. He was 95 years old. Everything else in that house was floor-to-ceiling records. You couldn't walk. You couldn't move. There was no operating toilet. There was no operating shower. It was a complete disaster. The roof was leaking. There was mold everywhere. In addition to collecting records, he collected 16-millimeter film, and the stench of rotting vinegar film in the house was so bad you couldn't hardly walk or think or be in that house for very long. My son walked in with me, took one look, and said, I'm out of here. I don't even want to go in this house. But I stayed there for a whole week excavating through all these mountains of records. You had to move records to find out that there was a staircase to the upstairs floor. Then you move all the records off the staircase, get up to the top floor. You can't open any doors because there's records piled in front of them. When you open the door, you can't go in because there's records all the way to the back. Try to control your hobby a little bit and don't let that happen. Yes, yes, I did. I rescued about 4,000 mostly radio transcriptions of 1930s radio programs, Burns and Allen, all kinds of fun stuff, early stuff from the early to mid-30s. So love your records, but don't become a hoarder like that. I've seen marriages ruined by records. Don't let that happen to you. I've been married for 32 years. She's sitting back there, and she tolerates all of this. So, but don't let it get excess where they don't tolerate it. Not a good idea. So before we take questions, I have four simple rules for record collecting. Rule number one, there is life outside of records. Go live it. Number two, your wife, your kids, and your family are more important than any records you have. So make sure you keep that in perspective. Third, your relationship with God, coupled with honesty and personal integrity, is the most important of all. You can have all the records you want, but if you don't have a good relationship with God and are not honest and do not have integrity, it all isn't going to matter. And the last rule, have fun, and when you find some rare blues records, call me. All right, questions. Do we have a microphone somewhere? Okay. Carrie.
John, I had a question relating to supply and demand.
Okay.
As you know, the supply is what is a key factor for you.
Right.
Demand is something that you can't control. And I've noticed how the mainstream media can create a demand for records that might not have been as valuable before that happened.
Case in point,
when Ken Burns' Jazz came out, it ignited an escalation in the value of Billie Holiday records, especially
right.
Strange Fruit on Commodore, yeah. which is a common record, extremely common. But when you watch the eBay results of that after Ken Burns, they shot up into the stratosphere. They've kind of leveled off since then. Do you have any other advice regarding this kind of thing with the media controlling the value?
Be knowledgeable and don't get sucked into something like that. There's nothing wrong with Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday. It's a great record. If you want to own one, own it. But don't go out and overpay for it just because some film says that it's an important thing. If it's genuinely rare, good idea. If it's common, don't. Unless you want to own it.
Thank you.
Some of us were a little surprised last year, I think it was, when the earliest known recording of a black quartet on a cylinder from 1893 was sold. Surprisingly good condition, too. And it sold for $1,000, which seemed not much for something like
that. Not much for something like that.
I'm sure you're familiar with that sale.
Yes.
Do you have a comment on why that would be?
It just doesn't have the attraction of a Charlie Patton Paramount or a Robert Johnson. It's significant for what it is, but you have to have the buyers there in order for it to go up like that.
So you don't think the circumstances of the sale can sometimes affect, or the knowledge that it's being sold, that kind of thing?
No, I would have predicted that it would sell for something like that, maybe more, but not much. Way in the back. He's got to run.
I'm not a record collector. I'm a writer on history of jazz and on the record industry. When I need a record, it's because I'm using it as a tool in my writing, and I can't get it, say, on a reissue, or it's only part of a 10 or 12 CD reissue. What advice would you have for acquiring a record where the purpose is simply to get a good utilitarian copy at the lowest possible price as a research tool?
I have no idea. I'm the one that buys everything at the highest possible price. I can't answer that question. Sorry.
I had a question about the object versus the audio within and the access to it, a little related to the reissues that you mentioned. And I was wondering, you've seen instances where a rare record has been reissued or made available for free, maybe from an institution, and the value of the object has gone down or up. Is there any relations between that?
There can be. Just look at those people who collected LPs. A lot of the value in it. I didn't even mention LPs in my talk because I'm really not a proponent of LPs. I sell them on occasion, but I found that most LPs, as a rule, first of all, if somebody was selling enough in some way to convince a record company to put out an LP, they were selling. And then those LPs, for the most part, were selling. There are some rare LPs, but not rare compared to these early Paramount 78s and other things. So you can see how cheaply you can buy some LPs now that some years ago were not so cheap. There's also sometimes when, yes, they reissued, the people that were really had a fever to buy the original are satisfied with the reissue, so the number of potential bidders for that LP original has dropped, and so they tend to fall off. The genuinely rare ones, though, will still find buyers. People are still interested in the actual artifact as well as the sound that comes from it. Way in the back.
Good morning. Hi, John, that was great. I've got a question about that example you mentioned, this house.
Yes.
And that's an incredible visual description. What about the film that was molding? You're talking about nitrate film, original?
Well, nitrate, yes.
What were you able to salvage from that?
I didn't salvage any of it. I have no real knowledge of nitrate film other than it will explode, and once it starts turning to vinegar, it's pretty much destroyed. That much I know. So there may be something salvageable in there. I told the son that he should at least put that stuff in one place, and I was going to try to help him find somebody that could look at it, but I think most of it's pretty much gone. Well, it had a real heavy vinegar smell. Okay. I don't know. I'm not a film person.
Okay, we're going to have to move on to the next sessions.
We're done? Okay, thank you.
I thought Fred Williams' house had already been cleaned out.